From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. After Tuesday, analysts are asking big questions about how campaigns work in the 21st century.
You know, does field work produce what we thought it traditionally did? And maybe it doesn't anymore. Or maybe there's a point where voters kind of tune out to that type of stuff.
Later on the show, a Wisconsin man's memoir of his service in Vietnam, and a Milwaukee writer goes searching for the site of his dad's fatal plane crash in World War II.
This is the week we remember, and today is the day we remember, Veterans Day. Didn't have the opportunity to become a veteran, but it's to remember everybody who sacrificed.
Plus, Bubbler Talk looks for Milwaukee's oldest buildings, and we'll hear about the latest in a series of mysteries based at Old World, Wisconsin. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Political scientists are still trying to paint a complete picture of what transpired on Tuesday to win Donald Trump the presidency. Many are especially interested in Wisconsin's vote, as the state sided with a Republican after decidedly backing Barack Obama in the past two presidential elections.
Christopher Murray is a visiting instructor at Marquette University's Les Aspin Center for Government in Washington, D.C. He told WUWM's Annalise Hensel that some of the most interesting data comes from Milwaukee County.
The percentage of the vote that Hillary Clinton got was essentially identical to the percentage of the vote that Obama got. So they did equally well among the people who voted. But what is different is that it looks like a little over 60,000 fewer people voted in Milwaukee County than voted in 2012. So just kind of looking at that in terms of some raw numbers, Hillary Clinton got about 44,000 fewer votes in Milwaukee County than Barack Obama did. Now, Donald Trump also got fewer votes in Milwaukee County than Mitt Romney did. It's about 29,000 votes different. So it's kind of interesting in that across the state of Wisconsin, it looks like about the same number of votes were cast in Wisconsin as were cast 4 years ago. So turnout would seem to be about level. But in Milwaukee County, there was fewer votes cast. So something was going on in Milwaukee County where fewer people were voting than 4 years ago. And from the perspective of the Hillary Clinton campaign, that is the most important county for you or for any Democrat to win Wisconsin, is you need to run up really big numbers in the biggest, most Democratic county in the state. And the fact that she fell behind what Obama did, again, not in terms of percentage, but in terms of overall numbers, I think went quite a ways to explaining why Republicans won Wisconsin for the first time since 1984.
Throughout the campaign, I had heard a lot about Hillary Clinton's great ground game compared to Donald Trump's, that she had a lot of workers in the field, a lot of offices, a lot of people getting volunteers signed up to support her and help get people out to vote. What do you think happened that made those efforts not as successful as she would have hoped here?
That's really interesting because, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think some people are probably going to speculate that the voter ID legislation had something to do with that. Milwaukee County has a higher percentage of people who have traditionally been less likely to vote as a result of those types of laws, namely minority voters and younger voters. So one of the things I would maybe watch over the next couple of weeks as people really start digging into these numbers and looking at states like Wisconsin that have these laws on the books to see if turnout did in fact go down in those places compared to what it was in the most recent couple of elections. Because, yeah, thinking about field staff, I mean, all the numbers that I had seen leading into the election was that Clinton had about 4 to 5 times as many field staff as the Trump campaign did. And so I think a lot of people who kind of run campaigns and have run them in a more traditional fashion are really going to be thinking about, you know, does field work produce what we thought it traditionally did? And maybe it doesn't anymore. Or maybe there's a point where, you know, voters kind of tune out to that type of stuff. Because it's hard to understand why, you know, turnout did go down in Milwaukee. And we don't have, you know, a sense of who exactly those people were who didn't turn out as opposed to 4 years ago, if they were more likely to be young or African-American or whatever. I don't have a sense of the answer to that really clearly yet. But that is something that especially I think Democratic folks in Wisconsin are going to be trying to figure out, because that's always been how you win as a Democrat in Wisconsin, is you run up big numbers in Milwaukee County. The interesting thing also, looking at some other places across Wisconsin, is if you go over to Madison in Dane County, there was very little change compared to 4 years ago. Hillary Clinton got about 1,000 more votes than Barack Obama did, and Trump got about 10,000 fewer votes than Mitt Romney did. But there was a pretty sizable Gary Johnson vote over there in Dane County, so you might think that those would normally be Republican votes. So Dane County was essentially unchanged as compared to 4 years ago. The numbers are almost identical. The percentage that Hillary Clinton got was exactly the same as Barack Obama did. And so it kind of mirrors Milwaukee County in that way. The percentages were exactly the same over those two elections. But the overall vote total was about the same in Dane County, and it didn't drop like we saw in Milwaukee County.
Do you think that there was a Bernie Sanders factor here? He did win Wisconsin in the primary, but I guess I'm about to negate what I just asked you, because you mentioned that the change really was seen in Milwaukee County, not in Dane County. So
right.
It seems to me that if there were a Sanders effect, that it would be felt elsewhere as well.
Right. And here another couple of interesting things I found, and I haven't gone through every county yet, but the two largest Republican counties in Wisconsin, Waukesha and Ozaukee, Hillary Clinton did better in them than Obama did. She actually improved on Obama's performance in those two counties. She didn't win them, clearly, and lost them pretty handily, but she got about 5 points better than Obama did in Waukesha County and 8 points better than Obama did in Ozaukee County. This is really kind of interesting to think about, too, is that were there a lot of more traditional Republicans in those counties who did not vote for Trump and actually voted for Hillary Clinton? And so what really seems to be happening is that we've got a really different story going on in the smaller, more rural, outer counties in Wisconsin than what we've got going on in the more metropolitan population centers.
Christopher Murray is a visiting instructor at Marquette University's Les Aspin Center for Government in Washington, D.C. He spoke with WUWM's Annalise Hensel.
We'll take a quick break now, and then a Wisconsin man breaks his silence on his Vietnam service in a new memoir. We'll speak with him when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It is Veterans Day. It's a time when we honor veterans for their service to our country. It's also a time when veterans themselves often reflect on their time in the service.
They're not always pleasant memories. Today, Mark Miller is an associate professor of business at Carthage College, but there was a year he once said he'd never talk about, a year spent as a sergeant on the front lines in Vietnam.
But he broke his silence, however, with a memoir of that time called My Confessions from Vietnam. He talked about it with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and explained why now was the time to write this book.
I was drafted. I didn't want to go to Vietnam. My options were to run away to Canada, to join the reserves or the National Guard if I could, or to go to jail. So I chose to serve, but I was a very reluctant soldier. When I got back, there was war protests going on. People were calling soldiers who were coming back baby killers. So I tried to put the whole episode behind me as quick as possible. But I always wanted to be a writer. So I kept a journal all the time I was in Vietnam. But when I got home, I stuck it in the bottom of a drawer and forgot about it. Probably about 15 years ago, I was speaking at a conference in Washington. And my wife and I went out there a couple days early. And we toured the Vietnam Memorial, the wall, and I kind of lost track of the people in my squad that I got to know pretty well for 7 months because we were all reassigned and went to different places. And so I was curious to see if all of them got back safely. And I was shocked to see that one of the people in my squad was killed in Cambodia after we were broken up. And that kind of brought the memories back. And then I talked to my daughter a few years ago, Brooke, who's a very good writer, and I told her that I was thinking about doing something with my journal, and she really encouraged me and helped me to write it.
Did you hear any feedback from anyone, friends or even strangers, who were strongly against the Vietnam War when it was happening? As you mentioned, protests, there were draft card burnings, people just vehemently hated the soldiers who were coming back, even though they might have been drafted like yourself and didn't really have a choice in the matter. Did they apologize for the way perhaps they treated or thought of the soldiers returning home during that time? Did this change any perspectives?
I really haven't heard from anybody, but I think it's great now when I see people lining up to welcome veterans home. Thank you for your service. Veterans Day is a much bigger deal than it used to be, and being a soldier is the hardest job in the world as far as my experience has shown. So I have nothing but respect to anybody that voluntarily chooses that as a career.
Do you keep those separate in your mind? You consider yourself a bad soldier and you were drafted versus the people who serve voluntarily. Do you still not feel worthy of the classification of people? As you mentioned, you feel uncomfortable and you say thank you for your service when you felt it wasn't a service at all.
Yeah, I do. I think I'd agree with that. And I think there's some real lessons for business in this. If you have people that don't want to be with your company and that aren't supportive, they're not going to be good employees. And I think the same thing holds true with the military. What we saw, something like 25% of the soldiers in Vietnam were draftees, like myself. And it's difficult to do anything with a team that part of the team doesn't want to be there.
You mentioned you came in as a higher rank because you had a college degree. What was your experience like with other soldiers, whether they were drafted or there voluntarily, who kind of scorned the higher officers because they just came out of college and weren't working their way up in the field?
Well, I wasn't an officer. I was drafted the business degree, college graduate, so they said he must be an infantry person. And I went through basic at AIT, and they came to me and said, if you choose to, we will send you to this NCO school, affectionately known as Shake and Bake School in Fort Benning, Georgia, and in 13 weeks you will be a sergeant, which is a squad leader. It's not an officer, but it is a squad leader, and you do have some management responsibility, leadership responsibility. So I thought the war might be over by that time. So I did volunteer to go to NCO school. But I'm sure as far as the military was concerned, I wasn't a very good leader because my mission was to get back safely and get my squad back safely, not to rid the world of the Red Menace or fight a war and kill people.
Right. Part of your story kind of surprised me of just the things that had to be done for numbers' sake, where you counted pigs in a village as casualties or, you know, enemies down.
Yeah, I think if you look back in history about the casualties that were reported on the news all the time, you know, 100,000 North Vietnamese killed and 10 American soldiers killed, things like that. So the numbers were greatly inflated, and I think it had to do with propaganda.
How old were you when you were drafted and then landed in Vietnam?
I was 22 when I was drafted, and I spent a year in the States before I went to Vietnam.
At such a young age, and in addition to being drafted where a lot of your fellow soldiers are anywhere in that 18 to maybe 25 range.
Well, I was one of the old guns.
Grandpa was 26,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do you think your year in Vietnam at such a young age shaped the man you became?
You know, it's interesting because I was asked to speak at a local APEX professional development meeting, and they wanted to know management lessons or what I learned from Vietnam. And I really hadn't thought about it in that way. And I did in the last chapter try to talk about a couple learnings, but I certainly learned that I never wanted to touch a gun again, and I haven't. I learned that I never wanted to sleep on the ground outside again, and I haven't. But I also learned that people from all over the country that I met that were in my squad, many of them without high school degrees, different backgrounds, different ethnic origins, were just terrific people. So I think it taught me a tolerance and appreciation for everybody.
Which was quite a contrast to the dynamic you came home to, correct?
Yes.
Do you think setting aside your service in Vietnam, coming back as a strictly a civilian and pushing that away for so long, do you think that hurt your mentality internally in any way? Or do you think maybe not sharing this part of your life with your family or your close friends, what were you trying to maintain?
I think it was probably a good thing for me because I wasn't ready to relive it until just recently. And I view it now entirely different than I would have 30, 40 years ago. So I think it was a good thing. Just from the perspective that I can think about what I learned and how it might have helped me, I couldn't have appreciated that at all at the time.
How were you able to appreciate it differently through a writer's perspective, too? How did that influence your decision on how to recreate your story?
Yeah, my journal itself was just disjointed. And writing that, you had to recognize, how do you make something that flows, has some kind of continuity to it, you develop some characters, it has a beginning, middle, and end that makes some sense. So it is a completely different perspective as a writer than just reviewing the journal.
With military service, do you still view the military in the way you did when you served? And how has that changed for you?
Well, I think I now have greater appreciation for people in the military. When I just got out of the service, I wanted nothing to do with the whole idea of the military. And I'm still, I think a key learning is, at least from my perspective, there's no way you can win a guerrilla war when you don't know who's a friend and who's an enemy. And it seems like we keep repeating those same mistakes. How long have we been in Afghanistan and Iran, or how long we were in Iraq? And there's several guerrilla wars going on throughout, because I think people have realized how effective that type of war is. I don't know. It's completely different than the wars we fought before. And I'm not sure we even now have a handle on what we can do to win those type of wars.
You mentioned you also never picked up another gun, don't believe in violence, even got rid of a bat next to your bed. Is that a lesson that you think most veterans should work to pass on more to the general public? Violence, it doesn't necessarily solve everything.
Sure. And I'm looked at as being strange because I don't like my grandsons playing with toy guns. My kids never had any toy guns growing up. All my friends with concealed carry have guns and going to the range all the time to shoot. And what I saw in Vietnam, there was more injuries, deaths that I saw from friendly fire accidents than there was purposely. So, I'm certainly carried through or still have those opinions. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, I'm just curious as to if other veterans you've spoken to have similar opinions.
Not all of them.
For some of them, do you think their time in the service reaffirms carrying a gun or acts of violence?
Yeah, you want to be able to protect yourself. The criminals can always get weapons, and so we have to be ready to protect ourselves. But that isn't my view, but I can understand that opinion.
What message do you want your book, your confessions, your experience from Vietnam to send to one fellow veterans, whether they served in Vietnam or even other current wars? And then what do you want the message to be for civilians?
Well, there's three messages I identified in the last chapter. Appreciating the military was one. The other two has to do with taking risks and not being afraid. When I was first over in Vietnam, I was in an experience where a lot of people were injured, and I was scared to death for 24 hours. I couldn't stop shaking. And somebody came to me and said, "Sarge, you got the frights. You got to get over those or you'll drive yourself crazy." From that time on, I kind of had the attitude of take a risk. Don't be afraid. It's all going to turn out all right. And a lot of things I've done in life, including being here today and writing the book, speaking in conferences, changing career to be a professor and so forth, was me deciding to take a risk and not being afraid. So I'd say to anybody, put it out there, take a risk, lean in is my first message. The second message, the way I got out of the combat position over Vietnam, is a friend I barely knew at school, a nerdy type who was accountant type, ended up being a clerk that worked for a major that made all combat assignments in Vietnam. He heard that I was over there and basically forged the major's signature on orders to get me into a cushy rear area job. I owe my life to him as far as I'm concerned. And throughout my career, there is other people that have helped me. Network, the more people you know, keep close to people, help other people out, and it'll be rewarded 100 times. Those would be my recommendations for anybody.
They're good lessons to learn, and Mark Miller, I'd like to thank you for sharing your experience with me today.
Thank you very much again for having me.
Absolutely.
Mark Miller's new book is called My Confessions from Vietnam, written with his daughter, Brooke Miller Hall. Miller is an associate professor of business at Carthage College in Kenosha, and you can listen to him read an excerpt from the book at WUWM.com. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski.
Coming up next, a Milwaukee writer tells the difficult story of his dad's fatal World War II plane crash and the modern-day search for it. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Near the end of World War II, Army Air Corps Lieutenant Lauren Hintz was based in Italy when his plane was shot down. He was considered missing in action until parts of the wreckage were found a while later, and he was declared to have been killed. But the crash site was never found before this year.
Milwaukee writer Martin Hintz was not yet born when his father died. This summer, a team of people helped him uncover his father's crash site in Italy. Hintz joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about the long search for where his father died.
My dad was a prolific writer, and he wrote books of poetry, and he even knew Carl Sandburg, kind of an interesting young man from the 1930s. And after he died, of course, they sent home in a trunk my dad's personal effects, his dress uniform and different things. So my mom had that up in the attic. And as a kid, I'd sometimes go upstairs and kind of open the sacred trunk and look in and kind of hold his caps and some other things and thumb through his writings. He had a lot of letters and, of course, his books of poetry and little things from his growing up years. So it was as if I kind of knew him. Hadn't met him, but I knew him and finally had an opportunity to meet him this past summer, literally. It was kind of quite an emotional experience.
Before you started the excavation process and even the process of just finding that crash site in general, what did you know about the crash?
He took off April 21, 1945, several weeks before the war ended, and he was based at an Italian air base called Cesenatico. And there were records. The chaplain found a few things several months after the war. He was listed as missing in action for a time, because there was so much going on in that area as the war was ending. There was, you know, rubble and debris everywhere, and people were hungry and all that. And the first graves detail was able to find some remains of my dad and a few pieces of his airplane. But they were in a hurry to move on to the next place. Everybody probably wanted to get home. The war was over, and there was just so much they had to find. They had all these service people that were missing and all this. So those remains were transferred to the American Cemetery just near Florence. There was about 4,000 service people in there who died toward the end of the war, mostly fighting in northern Italy. And then that kind of was it. That was 71 years, and all the records kind of disappeared. And, well, we didn't know where they were. And about 10 or 12 years ago, my sister took my mom down to our local library in Iowa, where we grew up, and played around on the internet. You know, it's kind of all brand new way, way back then, to see some, see if they could find some reunion information about his 79th Fighter Group, because at that time there were a lot of the men and women of the service were trying to get together again. And my nephew Hans also got involved and was quite interested, and they threw out some emails, queries, and nothing, 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 nothing. And a few years ago, my nephew Hans was in Alaska. He's an engineer, and he was talking with a friend, and it turned out that they wound up talking about World War II, and this gentleman's father-in-law was in the 79th Fighter Group. Oh, so was my grandfather. Next thing you know, they're talking, and this gentleman, the elderly gentleman, knew my dad. So we were able to meet and talk with him. This was about 5 or 6 years after those first queries went out online. And he talked a lot about that era and my dad and things like that. And as all this was floating around, my sister and my nephew did get some messages from some Italians. Said, it's our mission. We're looking to repatriate, to find remains of American service personnel to thank them for their service. And that led to eventual discovery after searching for records, and we went to the National Archives and everywhere else to find information.
So this was an effort not only spurred by you and your family, but also by a group of Italians.
Yes, and we can't say enough for our friends, because now they are our friends overseas. And at first, you know, each side was kind of, well, who's looking for what? Like, is this real? And it certainly turned out to be, because Hans was able to go to Italy a few years ago and meet these people. They're all aviation buffs. They were flyers. And they took this as their cause. They kind of lived near Bologna. That's where it's near where the crash site was. So they were all people who aviation enthusiasts and parachutists, and they all just love the air. And they took this on as their cause. And for about 8 or 9 years, they crisscrossed that area trying to find the proper coordinates where my dad could have been shot down. And they were, as I mentioned, Cesenatico, the air base. They flew out. There's an Italian air base now. So they were able to track his flight path and crisscross, fine. And they never really had any exact specifics. And then working, because my nephew was an engineer, they were able to use some ground-penetrating radar. I'm not sure the exact scientific name for that. But they located a mass of metal in this one area, debris field, and that's where everybody started zeroing in on the search. And we went over there this past July wondering if what's down underneath there. There was another group of Italians who specialize in archaeology and digging up planes, and they had already found a number of American and Allied flyers in different places that had been missing for 70-some years, and were able to get them back to their families in the States. And so they joined up with our other Italian friends, and so that's kind of how it all got going.
Of course, Italy is a country with roots that go way far back. We're looking at pretty recent history. So you were able to speak with people who had seen the crash or who had at least been there during World War II when all of these planes were overhead. You know, what did they say to you about their experiences?
Well, everybody had a story. That was toward the end of the war, and the German army was fleeing to the north to try to, you know, get out of the way, because since my father flew a P-47 fighter bomber, it was the biggest, a single seat, one man in the plane, And they were taking out railroads and anything that moved on the roads. There was no more Luftwaffe. The skies were clear. So our allies, their job was to clear the ground as these enemy troops were fleeing north. And folks in the area remember everybody on horses, horse-drawn carts, walking, motorcycles, bicycles, all trying to get north, and they were trying to trade their uniforms for civilian clothes. And one lady who's now in her 90s remembers just a few months before their barn was bombed and a cow got killed, but a group of German officers came into their kitchen and got all soused up as they were fleeing, and they spent one night there and then took off again. And so they commandeered their kitchen, these German officers, and just ready to hightail it. And they said toward the end of the war, there were mostly young conscripts, German conscripts there, 16, 17, 18, and elderly guys. And not a lot of the old battle-hardened veterans from the Russian front, because they all had moved on. So that was my dad's job, to help clear the remains of the German army out of that area.
So what happened with the crash itself?
Well, everything is conjecture, who knows. But with these various eyewitnesses and people who kind of knew of the situation, he took off from Cesenatico like about 6:30 in the morning and arrived on. He was number 12 in a flight of 12 P-47s, and he was the last man. And by the time he came through, they were attacking a row of farmhouses, 300 to 500-year-old farmhouses. We're talking history here, and the walls are like 3 feet thick and everything. So there were some German gunners that their responsibility was to take out. And he was the last one to make a pass. And apparently the gunners had zeroed in on him by that time. And his flight mates didn't notice he was missing until they had circled around and had taken off, headed back. And people in the neighborhood remember that a group of New Zealanders had come through, wireless operators, the night before, and told them there's going to be a big raid tomorrow, so be really careful, go hide. And they got them up like early in the morning and said, they're on their way. And this family, they hid in a drainage ditch behind their house. And he remembers the flight going over and a huge explosion. And I think it was one of their relatives' homes that they were attacking. So I tell you, this is, personal stuff. And from a distance, like a quarter mile away, they could see something had gone down and a huge explosion. So that was one eyewitness to something. So either my dad was either hit or, I don't know, the plane malfunctioned or whatever, but it was a huge explosion. And they were only 800 feet off the ground, flying about 200 miles an hour, so he burrowed right into the ground, and that's why we had to do a dig.
So you were part of the actual excavation process, right?
Well, we observed, my family and I, my sister and my three kids, and my sister's two of her sons were able to come along, too, because it was pretty technical. These people had really skilled professionals, and even though they're amateur archaeologists, they knew what they were doing. As I said, they had found a number of other downed pilots, and it was also a safety factor too. We came out really early the morning of July 23, and the area was marked off where they wanted to dig, and they said, we know he's down there. And my sister and I looked at each other and said, wow, how do you know? And he said, well, we just have faith. And they went over the whole area with metal detectors. There were a couple of dozen of these people. And then they started digging. And within minutes, they started finding wreckage. And then down 20-some feet, they found the plane and his remains, his dog tags, his artifacts, flare guns, things like that. So,
how did you feel when they were pulling these things, way deep out of the ground? I mean, did it feel cathartic? Was it emotional?
Well, quite emotional, yes. The Italians were so reverent and cautious. They would put the debris in the shakers, like you've seen pictures of archaeologists working to shake down to find the most minute particles, and they found a lot of unexploded ordnance that they had to take care of. The Italian Army was there, the Italian Air Force was there, the Carabinieri, the police, several hundred people, onlookers, were watching, and we were part of that. And when they started finding my dad's remains, they had a small tent set aside that the family could kind of go quiet time. And his, as they found remains, they were placed in a metal box, and it was kind of reserved for us. And noon of that day, the local parish priest came out and blessed everybody, all the workers and the people, and that was just really quite emotional. And following that, we were led over to an open space where a group of Italian parachutists presented an American flag to my sister, and they played Taps and the Star Spangled Banner, and everybody got quite sniffy, of course, you know, at that particular time. And it just went on from there, and there's more to the story as we get into it, too. And we were just so lucky to find him, and just remember all the other service personnel for all the wars. This is the week we remember, and today is the day we remember, Veterans Day. And my dad didn't have the opportunity to become a veteran, but it's to remember everybody who sacrificed, not just his story. It's our country's story.
Well, Martin Hintz, thank you so much for joining us here in studio, and thank you so much for your father's sacrifice.
Well, I really appreciate it, and my family thanks everybody who's interested in it. And once again, there were so many people helping, not just us, and so I want to be sure that they get their credit as well.
Martin Hintz is a local historian and writer who journeyed to Italy on a search for the site of his father's 1945 World War II plane crash. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, an appropriate bubbler talk for election week. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
My name is Emily Polly, and my question is, what is the oldest building in Milwaukee? I work in the Mitchell Building downtown, which is a pretty old building. I believe it was built in the 1870s. And knowing that Milwaukee is older than that, I figure there must be something older than what I work in.
I'm Bob Giese, and I'm with Historic Milwaukee.
I met up with Emily and Bob in the lobby of the Chase Tower, 111 East Wisconsin Avenue. Emily's question may seem straightforward, but as Bob explains, it's not quite that simple.
Prior to the city hall we have now, there was a much smaller city hall, and it wasn't large enough for all the records, and records were kept in different places. And there were fires, and fires destroyed some of these records. Now, the one building we know for sure the date is Old St. Mary's Church, but we have another building downtown that may precede that.
We head out to the east entrance of Chase Tower and cross Water Street. We continue east till we hit the corner of Michigan and Broadway. Then we hang a left, walk past the Hilton Garden Inn, and nestled there is a small shop.
And this is Linelli's, and this was a tavern at one time.
Are you getting excited?
Yeah, this looks kind of like what I thought it would.
Hello, are you Mike?
We're greeted by Mike Iannelli, owner of the Iannelli's Custom Shop and Upholstery Business. Our shoes squeak on the clean tile floor. Old photos and artifacts line a section of the wall. A colorful painting depicting a scene from the Orient catches the eye, resting above rolls of fabric that lie on workbenches. There are wooden chairs, some with fresh upholstery, some not. Classic music floats through the air. It already feels like we've walked into another time. Our eyes are drawn to a picture frame full of artifacts, political candidates advertising their campaign for office.
William J. Carey for Congress. Is this what you would have expected, Emily?
Yeah, this is very cool.
The photo of the original marble hall is stunning. An elegant, ivory-colored bar so clean it shines with elaborate ornamentation on every surface. A giant mirror is opposite the bar with a row of taps at one end and a palm at the other. Classic black and white tile stretches like a pristine chessboard across the floor into the next room. The whole scene is pure elegance and decadence. The name Marble Hall certainly fits. But much more than drinking happened over this bar, as we learn from this Wisconsin News article, dated back to 1933.
Although Marble Hall was actually a saloon, the name fixed itself to the entire building and identified the gambling rooms on the second floor. The saloon took its name from the marble top of its bar. It was a whiskey saloon, as old Milwaukee distinguished hard liquor places. Marble Hall was political headquarters for the entire state. Governors and mayors rubbed elbows there. Alfred Pawinski, the last owner of Marble Hall before Prohibition, was sentenced to 11 months in jail and fined $3,000 for selling liquor in 1921. Pawinski's old customers, many a prominent politician among them, intervened, and a pardon from President Harding was the result.
As we head out of the shop, I ask Emily what she thinks.
When I asked the question, I didn't realize I was going to get to see everything firsthand and that it was so close to where I work every single day. It just makes me think of like all of the history that's gone on around where I work and within this city. It's a lot to think about.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Do you have a question about our city that you've always wanted answered? Submit it online at WUWM.com and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
WUWM's Rachel Owens produced this week's Bubbler Talk.
For many of our faithful listeners, the name Chloe Ellefson may sound familiar. She is the protagonist of a series of historically themed mystery novels written by author Kathleen Ernst, a former interpreter and curator at Old World, Wisconsin. And it is that familiar place that sets the scene for the latest Chloe Ellefson mystery, A Memory of Muskets.
But if you're not a fan of mysteries, you may know Ernst from some of her other work. Ernst has written more than 20 books for the American Girl Dolls series. Ernst starts her chat with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, comparing her work with American Girl to the Chloe Ellefson mysteries.
It all comes under the history umbrella, and I really learned to love history as a child by reading good historical fiction. So it's a joy for me to be able to pass a little bit of my passion for history on to little girls today through the work that I do with American Girl.
Now, how many of those books have you you've written more than 20, you said? But
20, yes.
But how many characters have you written for?
Well, let's see. Well, I created the character of Caroline, their War of 1812 character. So that was really the pinnacle. I have also written books for Kirsten, Molly, two kit books, and a Josefina.
It's crazy.
It was great fun.
They're so iconic.
Yes.
What I will also say is, compared to the Chloe Ellefson character, I see a lot of similarities in this character with, like, the kind of people you meet in the American Girl novels.
Interesting.
She's this very strong character.
She is. Yes, she's strong. She goes after what she thinks is right, even if she thinks there's going to be a penalty for it. She doesn't take the easy way out. She feels passionately about people and about her job. And she does what she thinks she needs to do. It's an interesting comparison, but it's true, yeah.
I kind of compared her to Miss Marple, partly because, of course, it's a mystery novel, but also it seems like every time she gets close to something, someone dies.
Yes, the mystery effect. There is one, I think, one difference between Chloe and Miss Marple. I think Miss Marple enjoyed the hunt a little bit. And Chloe would be happy if she never came in contact with a crime in any way. She's a reluctant sleuth. She just wants to do her history thing and live in her history world and do research and things like that. But the way I've structured the Chloe Ellefson mysteries, some knowledge of the past is always needed to solve a present day murder, crime. And so she gets drawn in again and again because she always has the missing link, or she's the one that knows how to find the information that's needed.
She does seem reluctant in a lot of it. And part of what's interesting is as you see her, you know, going through these sort of historical points, you do see kind of, I don't know if the pain in research is the right word, but you do see that there is something that is difficult, that is difficult in the research.
I think one of the things that I wanted to share in the book, or in all of the books, when I worked at the museum world myself for quite a while, and I love doing research, but it's also very frustrating because no matter how much information you find, you're always aware that you're just really scratching the surface of what a human's life really was. You know, we'll never know what even very famous people were always thinking and feeling inside, what they were hiding. And Chloe is usually trying to find out something about people who were not famous, and perhaps they didn't leave any diaries or handy letters behind. And so she doesn't always find everything that she would like to find. And I started adding a thread of historical fiction in a lot of the Chloe books. And the reason I did that was to let readers in on the story. So readers get to go along. They get to meet the characters in the past that Chloe is trying to research. And by the end of the book, and in the newest book, A Memory of Muskets, this is particularly the case, the readers know more about the story than Chloe does. And that's just the reality of trying to learn about another time.
You do vacillate between this narrative of Chloe and of the past. Mm-hmm. Were you getting feedback that people were like, well, what happened? I wanted to know. Like,
you know, I didn't. The first book, I did not include a historical timeline, and no one mentioned that. And then in the second book, I tried it in a small way to see how readers would like it. And the feedback I got was overwhelmingly positive. And I think when you meet people that Chloe is trying to learn about, when readers get to meet them as characters, to understand not just what they're doing, but also what they're thinking and what they're feeling, it gives readers a chance to connect with them on an emotional level. I mean, that's in any book that moves us, it's because we've made some kind of a connection, a personal connection with the people that we're reading about in the book. And so I thought that that would be more satisfying for readers.
So Chloe, of course, does a lot of research mm-hmm. in the book, but you must have done a lot of research for this book.
I did. And for me, that's always part of the pleasure. It's a treasure hunt. You just never know exactly what you're going to find. A Memory of Muskets deals with German-American participation in the Civil War. And in the contemporary timeline, Chloe is organizing a program at her museum, Old World Wisconsin, about that. And in the historical timeline, we're learning about some of her boyfriend's ancestors who are German-American and trying to deal with the Civil War also. So because I worked at Old World Wisconsin myself and I used to be a Civil War reenactor, I did have a fair sense of the time, of what the characters' domestic lives were like. I needed to learn a little bit more about the military aspect of what German-Americans did in the Civil War. I start with books just to get some basic knowledge, and then I look for things like letters and diaries, and I go through newspapers from the locale where the characters live, which in this case is Jefferson County, and look for the details that 'll really bring it to life. And one of the things I learned was that some of the German men who signed up right away ended up training in Milwaukee, which was fun, and they left for war from Milwaukee.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned Rilke, and if we compare Chloe Ellefson to Sherlock Holmes, then Rilke is certainly her Watson. Is that sort of an accurate comparison? Or
It's an interesting comparison, yeah. They're definitely a team, just like Holmes and Watson. And the way the mysteries are structured, they each need to be involved, and they each bring their own skills and talents. And sometimes they're working closely on the same mystery. Every once in a while, they're in two different places working simultaneously on something that will converge by the end of the book. But I think that's the reason that they work so well, is because they each have a different skill set that they bring.
And this story is particularly personal for Rilke.
Yes. In the earlier books in the series, because this is the seventh book, A Memory of Muskets, in various books, we learn quite a bit about Chloe's Norwegian ancestry. So I thought by book seven, it would be fun and timely to learn a little bit about Rilke's ancestry, too. So he's just purchased his family farm where the first Rilkes lived when they moved here from Germany. And there's an old cabin on the farm, the very first structure. And Chloe is sometimes very sensitive to emotions that linger in old buildings, not always, but sometimes. And she feels something very strong in the cabin. She would describe it as a sense of hopelessness, which is kind of a shock for Rilke to hear that. So she embarks on research to learn about what happened to his earliest ancestors. Why would she feel that in this cabin? And as I was saying earlier, she doesn't find all the details that the readers are able to see, but she is able to discover a lot and help that situation a little bit. So Chloe's doing research at work about German-American participation in the Civil War, and then we have the personal layer as well.
As you said, this is the seventh book.
Yes.
Why do you keep returning to this character?
Oh, I love these characters. And I made a decision with the first book that Chloe would grow and change in each book and that there would be an arc to the series as the characters grew and changed, especially the two main recurring characters, Chloe and her friend Relke. So it's always new in that way. They're not stuck in the same year, in the same time. And the other reason is there are so many wonderful places in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. And one of my goals from the beginning was to share some of the historic sites and museums that I think are very special with readers who may not have ever been there or perhaps never had a chance to go. The other side of that, which is fun, is I get emails and letters all the time from people that say, oh, I read this book and it was so much fun because I could picture everything that happened. I'd been to Old World, Wisconsin, or I'd been to Rock Island. I have a long list in my head of different sites and museums that I would like to get to before I end the series.
How much of yourself is in Chloe?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Superficially, we are very much alike. She has a job that I used to have years ago. In the early books, she lives in a house that I used to live in. So a lot of things like that come from my own memory and are very easy to write. But as far as her person, her backstory, that is different. She is a fictional character. In some ways, she's stronger and braver than I would be. She's a little better than I am at speaking truth to power sometimes, which is something that I admire in her and is fun to write.
What's next for Chloe?
Well, I am well into the eighth Chloe book. It's not finished. My rough draft is not finished, and I don't like to talk too much about something until it's done. But I can say for all of my faithful, wonderful Chloe readers that the next book will deal with a new ethnic group that I haven't explored before and is set at a new historic site. So I'm having lots of fun with that.
Do you see an end to Chloe, or is it pretty open-ended?
In my mind, it's very open-ended. As I mentioned, there's just so many wonderful places I'd like to get Chloe and so many wonderful stories in our state's history that I would love setting a story against. So I just plan to keep writing as long as I can.
Well, Kathleen, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kathleen Ernst is the author of A Memory of Muskets, a Chloe Ellefson mystery. Ernst has an event at Tribeca Gallery in Watertown tomorrow at 10 and another event next Wednesday at Boswell Books. She spoke with Joy Powers. And that wraps up Friday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich, thanking veterans like my co-host for their service to this country. Our production team includes me and Bonnie, along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, Mayon Silver, and Kirsten Wisniewski, with additional support from Susan Benson, Rachel Morello, plus Michelle Manernowski and John Strelecki.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.